From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we hear from the executive director of Block about how they incurred civic engagement in 2020 and what they're focusing on now that the election cycle has ended. Then local artist Dick Blau shares his latest project, Milwaukee Night and Day, a photo film that captures 10 years of scenes from downtown.
And as I started looking at them for the ideas, the themes, the kind of suggestions of stories that were underneath them, I decided I would try to tease them out and make a larger story, which brought all of the work together.
We learn how to get rid of spider mites and why winter leaves houseplants so vulnerable to these pests.
Plants tolerate the damage until they're really stressed with the poor growing conditions. Low light, dry air, houseplants struggle, spider mites thrive.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Today, we'll learn about a film that features photos taken over a 10-year span. We'll tell you what to do if you got spider mites on your houseplants, and we give you some new music to check out in the Milwaukee Music Roundup. We'll start with this. Milwaukee activist groups were busy in 2020. From organizing racial justice protests to mobilizing voters for the presidential election. One of those groups was Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, or BLOC. They focused a lot of effort on election education and getting people to the polls. But the work doesn't stop just because the election cycle is over. WUWM's Mayon Silver spoke with Angela Lang, the executive director of BLOC, about what was accomplished in 2020 and the work she hopes to achieve this year.
I think the biggest goals for BLOC in 2021 is to make sure that we're keeping a certain level of engagement. We know that there was a lot of excitement and a lot of strong feelings about the November election, and we want to make sure that we're keeping that energy, we're keeping the connections to the voters and the residents that we talked to and engaged with last fall, and find other ways to plug them in. We tell folks we have an election in February, we have an election in April, so civic engagement doesn't just end at the ballot box. There's so much more. It's not like, you know, you vote and it's one and done. But you vote, you pay attention to the people and how they're voting, and you make sure that your voices are heard if they are not voting the way that you wanted them to when you elected them.
So BLOC's work is to lift up Black citizens, leaders, and businesses in the community. You've been asking community members for years now, what will it take for you to thrive? And you have a platform for prosperity on issues like safety, housing, health, and education. What are your biggest hopes for improvements in these areas in 2021?
Yeah, I think the two big things that we are the most concerned about immediately and hope that there's going to be some progress towards, obviously, is getting a handle on the pandemic and everything that comes with it, including making sure that our students are safe, they're able to learn at home safely, and parents have the tools and the resources to do that. We want to make sure that if people have to be out and are essential workers, that they are also being taken care of. So we know that this pandemic has a lot of different touch points, whether it's education or even increased domestic violence, unfortunately. We want to make sure that during the pandemic, people feel that they're supported. And also, people are still struggling. You know, $600 for a stimulus check barely pays some people's rent. And if you are a multifamily household, it can be really hard to get by. So making sure that people have relief, making sure that there's a moratorium on evictions, because if people are losing their jobs, they're not going to be able to pay rent and they shouldn't be evicted because of something outside of their own circumstances. So again, all of these different things that relate to the pandemic, whether it's specifically the vaccine and people feeling comfortable with the vaccine, or everything related to safety, schools, and keeping our students safe, et cetera. And the other thing that I think a lot of us are kind of holding our breath anxiously to see what the Biden administration does is having real conversations about what safety looks like in our community. We know that over the last several months, there's been conversations around defunding the police, or at the very least, divesting from it, being incredibly disappointed that our city council, after all of those protests, after all of the public outcry, they ultimately decided to take this federal grant to add more police. So, you know, we are going to be monitoring and paying attention to those particular votes, how they continue. We've definitely taken note of all the common council members that have voted for that. And we actually need to have real, true criminal justice reform. And that starts with divesting from the police department and investing directly into our communities.
And what are there a few things that you want the Biden administration in particular to contribute to Black Milwaukee in particular on these issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think, COVID relief would, I think, be great specifically for everyone across the board. But what also when it relates to criminal justice, we know that Milwaukee is home to one of the most incarcerated zip codes. It's notorious, 53206. And we really need to do an assessment of how we got here. And all signs point to the 94 crime bill. And that's something that President Biden can work on. That's a federal piece of legislation. That's a federal policy that we still see the effects of to this day with the COPS grant and the COPS program that we've just seen. But that was also something that he worked on when he was in the Senate. And so it's important to note that there is a federal piece of legislation that has directly impacted our community and has allowed 53206 to be the way it is. And this can be a time for him to make amends with his own past when it comes to criminal justice.
And looking back a little, what were your top three takeaways from mobilizing Black voters in Milwaukee during the 2020 presidential race?
I think the big thing was, one, our community is resilient, to know that in a pandemic, our community was challenged in so many ways, but to know and to see those heartbreaking and devastating yet powerful images of people standing in line that says, come hell or high water, I'm voting no matter what, I think is incredibly powerful. I think another big thing that we learned is the importance of having a year-round engagement. You can't just come in a couple weeks or a couple months before an election and persuade people that they should partake in a system that has at every aspect excluded us. And so being able to make sure that we are having these conversations on a year-round basis is incredibly important. And the last thing, is that organizing communities of color is just inherently different than some more privileged communities. I think some folks can send out an email blast as a reminder to vote, but it takes a lot more time and effort to have people build trust in a political system that wasn't meant for us. And so that's why it takes longer. And it's also more resources as well. It inherently just costs more to organize communities of color than majority communities and more privileged communities.
Neil Albrecht, former executive director of the City of Milwaukee Election Commission, he said that turnout in the City of Milwaukee has historically been within a few points of state turnout levels, but because of consistent restrictions on access to voting in the state that have disproportionately affected Black and brown voters in poverty, the turnout gap has widened. Can you weigh in on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think the most immediate concern and the most immediate effect is having people feel that they had to make the choice. Last April, that was the first time we saw it. People had to make a choice from, do I request a ballot? Oh, it didn't get here in time. And being faced with that choice on Tuesday and say, you know, either I sit this out for my own health and my own safety, or I risk my health to make my voice heard and I stand in one of the handful of voting sites. I think what's also interesting, and we saw this a lot last year, unfortunately, is rules were constantly changing. And sometimes it's hard enough to get information out there. If I have any questions about my ballot, I know who to call. I know where the election commission is. I know exactly who I can call, the phone number, but not everybody knows that. And then if you are, if the rules are constantly changing, especially 24 hours, 48 hours before an election, it can get very, very confusing. People on election day last April didn't know, you know, if the postmark rule was in effect or not. Could they still mail back their ballot? And these are, you know, some friends of mine who pay attention, and they were struggling with that as well. And so I think sometimes people intentionally try to mislead or confuse our community and constantly are changing the rules midway just to make things a little bit easier for them, or, you know, as a way for them to retain power, which is a challenge. And then also things like photo ID being an issue as well. We've seen the ever since like voter ID became a thing in some states, we see how it impacts turnout. And we know that photo ID, disproportionately impacts communities of color, students, the elderly. And those are all voting blocks that can be the make or break of an election.
Well, and Black was involved in several lawsuits last year, including one to try and expand the deadline to return absentee ballots. But there were also lawsuits brought by the Trump campaign at the end of the election, which challenged some of Wisconsin's election laws and longstanding interpretations of those laws by the State Election Commission. Are you preparing for Republican state lawmakers to take up this battle cry this legislative session?
Well, honestly, I would hope that they would have enough sense to not pursue further voting restrictions and to make it hard. If we actually want to be this land of democracy that we so claim, we wouldn't constantly make things harder for people. We would find a way to make sure that voting is accessible to every single person, whether that is the trans community and making sure that their IDs are respected, or it's anybody else that is dealing with challenges. We want to make sure that is accessible for people that are disabled, and making sure that there are accessible ramps to voting booths. You know, we see that there's a lot of different communities that sometimes are often excluded. And so we want to make sure that we are making it as inclusive as possible. Unfortunately, that should be the job of the legislators, but it's not, unfortunately. As decision makers and policy makers, we would think that they would do everything that they can to make it easier for the community. But with that not happening, then I think it's on us as community organizations to make sure that we're keeping up that pressure and giving out information as much as possible. I am concerned about how divisive the November election became, specifically when it came to misinformation, because we see how that has escalated and how that escalated to the events of January 6th. And misinformation was a really key component of that. And I would hope that the Republican legislature has enough sense to say that this election was not stolen, and not use it as a baseline to try and further disenfranchise more communities of color when it has been disproven time and time again. I lost count of how many cases the Trump campaign had. I think there were 60 or so, maybe 70 or so cases. None of them, you know, were valid. They were all dismissed or ruled against. And I think that's a telling sign that there were no issues when it came to this election, and that just because it didn't go the way that you wanted does not give you the ability to make voting harder for other people.
You spoke about misinformation. Do you think a sizable amount of Black voters in Milwaukee took heart the repeated lies and misinformation from President Trump and online sources like QAnon that the election was rigged and that they can't trust the results and things like that?
You know, I think everybody is susceptible to misinformation. I think the ability to be connected to somebody or an organization to say, hey, I saw this thing, is this true? I think is really important. And that I think that's where we come in. We've definitely heard, some things from our ambassadors, and they'll come back with stories and say, hey, I heard this. I wanted to push back because I feel like this wasn't true, but I wanted to double check with you first. And so I think a lot of times, you know, we were talking to people and people knew exactly the games that the Trump campaign was playing. People, I think, saw a lot of the misinformation for what it was. And then if there were any questions, I think a lot of times people questioned it, but didn't take it at face value, and often gut checked it with someone else, whether it was someone from our team or friends and family. So in our experience, when we talk to folks and even, you know, posting kind of Facebook status to hear, you know, some of the chatter from folks, by and large, we don't think a lot of our community was subjected to some of those conspiracy theories and misinformation specifically about QAnon and whatnot. I do think that just given our own history, we will be, skeptical of certain things because we have our own historical traumas with the healthcare system, for example. And so I think a lot of some people's concern is rooted in very valid concerns and not necessarily misinformation. And I think we just need to meet people where they're at if people do have questions. But by and large, I'm really glad that we didn't hear a lot of the conspiracy theories, and people really were able to kind of see through it and see exactly the Trump campaign's antics for what they were.
Another issue that's happening in state government is that Wisconsin is going to have to redraw its legislative boundaries this year after the U.S. Census comes in. Will Black be doing any lobbying or any petitioning on the issue of redistricting?
Yeah, so redistricting actually is a is an issue that we've identified in our staff retreat last year that we really wanted to pay close attention to, and just how unfair it is and how redistricting can really impact a lot of your daily life, but a lot of times people don't know it. Redistricting is not a sexy issue. It can be kind of wonky, but we kind of feel that it's one of these big overarching themes that when a lot of issues that we have related in Milwaukee or some challenges, we can really point back to the redistricting process as being part of the reason for that. So we are very passionate about it. Our ambassadors are trying to find creative ways to get the word out and let people know about the redistricting process. And we are working very closely with our partners at the National Democratic Redistricting Committee and Eric Holder's group, as well as All on the Line. So we find ways to partner with them as much as possible. I did recently testify at the 4th Congressional District hearing for the People's Maps Commission. Really glad that the governor has a People's Maps Commission where general, average people can testify and say their thoughts on the redistricting process, and collect that input. I hope that it is put to good use when the maps are actually being drawn. And it's something that we're going to keep an eye on. We're going to raise some noise about if we see that people are trying to draw them unfairly.
And finally, February is Black History Month. We're heading into that. Is there anything you want to share about Milwaukee's Black history that's inspired you or the history of Black that people should know?
I think I'm actually really looking forward to Black history. It feels a little bit different this year, given all the challenges that we've gone through over the last year. And one thing that I love about the Black community, specifically in Milwaukee, is how resilient we are and also how we're able to find joy where we can. So I just really look forward to being able to center and celebrate, our leaders, our ancestors, the work that we've done collectively, not just at Block, but our collective movement and how we've gotten to this point. I was just telling a colleague recently that sometimes people only talk about racial justice through the lens of death. When a Black man is killed or attempted to be killed or the murder of Breonna Taylor, that's the only time we really kind of talk about racial justice. But how are we talking about racial justice not from a standpoint of someone dying, but being able to celebrate each other, celebrate our community, and celebrate the achievements and accomplishments that we've had under really challenging times? So I'm really looking forward to that and being able to celebrate and honor trailblazers and to just use the month to celebrate. And I think that's something that we all could use as a community.
Angela Lang of Block, thank you for sizing up 2021 and looking over 2020. Thank you again for speaking about these things.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Angela Lang is the executive director of Block. She spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver about the organization's plans for 2021. On Monday, we'll hear from the executive director of the African American Roundtable on how that group plans to push the racial justice movement forward. Last Tuesday on Lake Effect, we also spoke with several other local activists fighting for racial justice about what they hope to accomplish in the new year. You can find that story at WUWM.com. Coming up in about 15 minutes, gardening expert Melinda Myers will give her tips on how to get rid of one of the nastiest houseplant pests. spider mites. But first, we learn more about Milwaukee Night and Day, a photo film that captures 10 years of life from a two-block radius downtown. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Dick Blau is an artist who lives in downtown Milwaukee at the intersection of Plankinton and Wisconsin Avenues near the Riverside Theater. A hub for central activity, Blau started taking pictures of the everyday scenes he'd see in his neighborhood 10 years ago. While his work usually focuses on interpersonal relations, music, and culture, Blau decided for the first time to focus on a large urban scene through photography. Milwaukee Night and Day is a film made from the hundreds of pictures he's taken on the same two blocks and is the newest version of Blau's 730 project, named for the building he lives in. Blau joins me now to share more about the project, and he starts with what inspired him to start taking photos around his building.
Well, it was a whole way, a whole new way of looking at the world for me. Naturally, when you have a camera, I try to use my camera every day, and our balcony was a perfect place to start. We had a view of the sky to the south, to the west, and then at the street, and all kinds of things were happening night and day. And so I just began making pictures of them. I didn't know what I was going to do with the pictures. I just made them at first, and then as the pile started to grow in my drawer. I started to think, well, what shall I do? And I noticed that there were two empty spaces down in the hall of our building, and I decided I would just put up a couple of pictures, tape them up to the wall, not put my name on them, not title them, not do anything like that, just have them there for a while. And as I did that, I began using it as a kind of an intimate, private exhibition space. And I would change the pictures. I basically try to put new pictures up every 7 to 10 days. And as the numbers of pictures grew, I then started thinking, what will I do with my drawers are starting to overflow? What shall I do with them? And I thought of the Milwaukee County Historical Society up the block. And they've got like a wonderful archive and two archivists. And so I gave them 200 pictures. And once I'd done that, I started thinking about a more public form of exhibition. And for that, I actually made a film, which is what we're talking about today.
Right. So with your short film, Milwaukee Night and Day, can you describe its concept of the course of a Joycean day? Is that a reference to James Joyce? And is this how you structured how you wanted to present this to people?
Yes. Basically, I had about 1,000 pictures. And as I started looking at them for the ideas, the themes, the kind of suggestions of stories that were underneath them, I decided I would try to tease them out and make a larger story, which brought all of the work together. And so I recorded sound with a colleague of mine, Yunnan Wang, who also became the editor of the piece, recorded sound in the neighborhood, in the square block where this all takes place. And then also asked a very fine musician friend of mine if he'd give me a couple of pieces of music to use as well. And so basically we shaped the film so that it begins at 4 o'clock in the morning, actually. I love photographing at night as well as during the day. So it begins at 4 o'clock in the morning. It's kind of half dream, half awake. And all of a sudden, as you kind of move up through consciousness, all of a sudden you're in Milwaukee Day, where you see all of the construction of all the activity that's going on in the neighborhood. And then from there, it moves to a study of the weather, of the beautiful fogs that come in, to a series of catalogs of things I found on the street. On one hand, paintings from the City Department of Public Works. On the other hand, things that people just kind of like leave that are scattered in this very, very heavily trafficked area. And so we would incorporate those into the film as well. And then as it moves on, it begins to become a more social film. I photographed the places where homeless people would sleep. I never photographed any homeless people themselves. I didn't want to interrupt their privacy, really. That leads into events of this summer, the protests that were downtown as well, the Black Lives Matter protest. And then it finds its way out down through the night and finally back into, we take a drink at Moe's, and then we find our way, kind of totter back upstairs and go to sleep. And that's the end of the film. So it covers, you know, it covers many, many urban experiences, things that that really happen in history, and also ideas about what it's like to walk past places where people who don't have places to sleep have to live, and what that means, what you feel about that. So I try to incorporate that sort of thing into the film and into the structure as well.
Well, and with the component of sound that you mentioned, did you find yourself listening more closely to your environment when you decided you wanted to incorporate more sound? You know, because it's so easy for us to get used to the background noise of our everyday surroundings, right?
Exactly. Both the idea of the pictures and the idea of the film is to draw things that are really part of our background into the foreground. So listening to sounds became very, very important, very lively. It's as though there are snatches of conversation throughout the film. We actually mic'd the river itself to give a kind of like wet feeling to parts of the film. So we can put the actually put the microphone into the river, and those sounds are in the film. There's sounds from the building of the new symphony space, in the Grand Theater. So it's, it has a range of these sounds from the bar, like waitresses talking about, you know, their work, things like that. So that kind of floats through the film along with natural sounds. And then there's also some very, very beautiful pieces of music which are part of it as well.
Yeah, and the scenes at Moe's when you could be in a restaurant with lots of people and hear the commotion of people talking, dishes clinking, you know, that strikes a bit differently now.
Yeah, it certainly does. It's really poignant.
With Milwaukee, we're often referring to ourselves as a city of neighborhoods. What do you want people to know about your neighborhood from watching Milwaukee night and day?
I think it's one of the most interesting places I've ever lived. It's alive 24 hours a day in all kinds of ways. It produces excitement. It produces anxiety. Sometimes because it's on west of the river, and it's now really getting developed. For a long time, it wasn't. So it was really a study of, you know, of the sounds of the night, as well as the birds across the street. I love the seagulls who nest on the Posner building. In fact, I kind of identify with them. So they're in their characters in the film as well. So it's really got this very, very rich, textured a sense of what it is to be in the very epicenter, right, of a place that has both mysteries and pleasures and events of historic impact.
So what guidelines did you set for yourself to distill 10 years worth of photos into a short film?
Tried to choose the best of them. I tried to build sequences out of them to what would really make sense one with the other. Yanan Wang, my editor, had a lot to do with that. For example, one of the things when you go on the streets, you know, there are parts of the film, so there are actually catalogs of things. In my catalog, I actually discovered a kind of secret folk artist who used to do installations at the bus stop at 2nd in Wisconsin. And so there's like a record of this person's work in the film. And then the question was, well, how to animate those catalogs? Because there were so many of them, you would be bored to death if treated them too slowly. So we'd find ways to condense them and run through them almost as in the same way that a pianist, right? A good pianist would work with a keyboard. And so we would try different rhythms with them and different combinations of them. So we developed certain principles. For example, we really tried to keep the, what we call the color temperature of the images somewhat similar, so that they would, even though they were very different, they would flow together and you could handle their difference rather than seeing huge disparities. That was really exciting. Yanan was really great. He's a really fine filmmaker in his own right. What I told him was, I want you to use these images as if you are really a magician and we're doing card tricks, right? And so you just take these, images and shuffle them together and pull them apart and shape them in various ways and find resonances with the music and the sound and develop a composition of your own, which I think he really did famously.
Yeah, it's a really great look at something we take for granted if we work downtown, or even just reminding us to pay closer attention to our environments every day.
Yeah, I think so. Part of what I was doing with my neighbors in the building was actually framing things that I knew that they would never really look at. and getting them to look at them and kind of like figure out what they were and where they were. So in fact, there's a level of kind of mystery and abstraction of what I'm doing that I'm really interested in, as well as things that identify specific places, specific moments, specific events. And so it's the combination of things that really is an attempt to kind of like bring the world around us alive, bring it to life, right? So that we're looking at it in a different way. You know, most of the time we go through the world, we shut ourselves off, can't stand it. It's too much there, right? But that's really enervating. And it's particularly, complicated when we're dealing with screens. Like, how do you actually make something on a screen come alive these days? We're with them so much. So what can you do to actually play with the appearance of the screen itself, the appearance of the image itself, the rhythm of the image itself, so that you can look at it again in a fresh way, make it new, really?
Well, Dick Blau, thank you for sharing your perspective with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Dick Blau is a local artist as well as professor emeritus of film, video, animation, and new genres at UWM's Peck School of the Arts. He joined us to discuss his latest project, photo film, Milwaukee Night and Day. As the pandemic continues to keep many of us in our homes, houseplants have become a refuge for people longing for the outdoors. But winter can invite new problems for houseplants. Dry air and reduced sunlight can be difficult for plants, but these conditions are great for pests like spider mites. Gardening expert Melinda Myers knows all about these pests and how to get rid of them. She joins Lake Effects Joy Powers to talk about it.
What are spider mites?
You know, that's a great question. They're really related to spiders, not true insects. And so that's really important to know, because many insecticides won't kill spider mites. And so when we're looking to control them, we need to keep that in mind. They're very tiny. So often we see signs or of the symptoms that spider mites are present rather than the insect, because they're so small, you'll need a hand lens to see them. So you may see a bronzing of the leaves. They have a piercing, sucking mouth part. It looks like a little needle that they inject into the leaf and then suck the plant juices. They secrete the excess as honeydew. It's a clear, sticky substance. And I find that's what gardeners usually tell me. They're seeing this clear, sticky substance and don't know where it comes from. You can take a sheet of white paper and shake the leaves over the paper. And sometimes you can see these little specks scurrying across the paper. And that's a way to see and maybe confirm that that is truly the problem you have. You don't want to wait for the webs, because by the time you see the webbing, you really have a high population of spider mites. It's still treatable, but it's a lot more work on your part.
I was about to say, I saw like little webs that appeared, and at first it was just on maybe one little leaf, and then now I was seeing, I didn't start to see webs on other things, but I did start to see little specks.
Yeah. So one of the things, too, is to isolate that plant as soon as you see it on one, is to, if you have the ability, to move it away from your other house plants to avoid infecting them.
I guess this gets to a bigger question, because when I started to look this up, a lot of people have been having this problem right now. How do you get them?
You know, great question. Well, first of all, the environment in our homes is perfect for spider mites. We've got the heat on, so the air is hot and dry, and that's where they thrive, and that's where our house plants suffer. So some may have tagged along when you brought them indoors, and as the growing conditions got worse for the house plants, or your house plants were struggling, the spider mites started building up in population. They may have hopped a ride in with another plant, maybe a holiday plant, or someone shared a gift plant with you. You may have picked them up somewhere when, you know, if you're checking out a plant, and, you know, it may have hopped along on you, which is kind of a creepy thought, but usually it's coming in with another plant, or if you buy potting mix that's not sterile, it may come along with that. But a lot of times what happens is there's small populations, but the plants tolerate the damage until they're really stressed with the poor growing conditions. Low light, dry air, houseplants struggle, spider mites thrive.
Now, you mentioned these are not really insects. They're much more related to spiders, which does make it difficult to get rid of them. What are some tricks that you use?
The first thing I'd recommend is really give your plant a shower. So I always kind of try to cover the potting mix so I don't get soil in the sink. If I take small plants to my kitchen sink or larger plants to the shower and then hose them off, and that can dislodge a lot of the insects. And if you can, spray the underside of the leaves as well as the above side. That's the first step. Then you can look for an organic control. Insecticidal soap, lightweight horticulture oils like Summit Year-Round Spray Oil will kill any of the spider mites they touch. Now, they're safe and organic, but you'll need to do repeat applications because they only kill what they touch. And so the good side is if you have kids and pets, you know, these are safe products. The systemics you can use, many of them, check the label, will work. But again, then that pesticide is in the leaves. So if you have a cat, like I do, that likes to munch on plants, you know, that's not good for your pets either. And kids that might be curious and munching on houseplant leaves, which, you know, we can always try to train both our kids and our pets not to do that. But you always want to be safe. So that's why I usually opt for an organic option.
So they're taking the nutrients out of the plant. What happens when the plant dies? What happens to the spider mites?
Well, they usually try to find someplace else to go. And so if you want to just prevent them from infecting something else, and, you know, they can hitch a ride on your watering can, or if you're doing some grooming on your tools or even your hands, you need to be careful you're not transporting them to another plant. This is where I decide great time to add them to the compost pile. If your plant dies, put that plant in the compost pile. It's cold outside. They're toast. And so that's one way to prevent their spread. You know, they're going to look for other plants to feed upon. So they're going to look for some source of food. And if they can't find it, they'll eventually die.
All right. Well, for people who are dealing with spider mites, hopefully this will get them out.
You know, persistence is the key. So always check that.
Melinda Myers, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Melinda Myers is an expert in all things gardening and the author of many books on the topic, including the Midwest Gardener's Handbook and Small Space Gardening. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and if you'd like to learn more about organic solutions to houseplant pests, Myers is hosting a webinar on the topic this coming Wednesday at 6:30. You can find more information at wuwm.com. Coming up, Matt Wild from Milwaukee Record joins us for the Milwaukee Music Roundup with some of his favorite songs released this month from Milwaukee musicians. He says 2021 is already shaping up to be a great year for Milwaukee music.
I would hope that this sort of thing would set the tone for the rest of the year. I like that we're going to be talking about a collaboration. I like that we're going to be talking about a song that involves a harp.
That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's a new year, which means a new batch of music from Milwaukee musicians. January can be a great time for artists determined to start the year with a new album, and 2021 is no exception. As always, Matt Wild has been listening. Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record, and every month he releases a nearly exhaustive list of new music from local musicians. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers with a sample of what he's been listening to for this Milwaukee Music Roundup.
Well, Matt Wild, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
It is great to be back in a brand new year. Thanks.
Brand new year. We have a really wide array of music from different local groups that we're going to be looking at. Do you feel like January is an especially good time for new music?
I think it kind of sets the tone in a strange way. And yeah, you're right. The selection I have this month is kind of all over the place, but some new stuff and one very old thing that has been reissued. But, you know, I would hope that this sort of thing would set the tone for the rest of the year. I like that we're going to be talking about a collaboration. I like that we're going to be talking about a song that involves a harp. So hopefully we just hear a lot of harp music out of Milwaukee in 2021. That's fingers crossed for me.
Looking forward to that. So this first song, I'm thinking, is not the one with a harp. At least I didn't notice it. But it is the collaboration.
This is one of those collaborations where I had to think to myself, have these two artists collaborated before? And if not, why haven't they collaborated before? Because it's such a wonderful pairing. I'm talking about Laurel Sulfate and her Ladies of Leisure, also known as her LOL, collaborating with a local super prolific electro wizard, Luxie. Laurel Sulfate and her Ladies of Leisure, back in 2019, they put out a record called Dance Music Saves Lives. It's this very, very poppy, very disco-y kind of record. Luxie, on the other hand, she is the kind of artist who, by the time we finish talking today, she will probably have put out about 7 new songs and 2 more video games to go along with those songs. She puts out music, new music, all the time. She just unveiled a virtual art gallery for Milwaukee visual artists. You can find that through her web pages. So she's super prolific, and pairing her up with Laurel Sulfate and her Ladies of Leisure is just such a great pairing. And they've gotten together to produce this track called Basement Show, which, as the title suggests, is a very dreamy, very electro ode to those beautiful things called basement shows, where you go to somebody's house, you go down in a crummy basement, and you're crammed in there with 100 other people, and everyone's sweaty, and it's wet, and it's dirty down there, and it's wonderful. And boy, oh boy, do I miss that. And boy, oh boy, do I miss any kind of shows, really. So it just pulls at my heartstrings. But it is a fantastic collaboration between these two fantastic artists. So let's listen to Basement Show.
Basement Show by Laurel Sulfate and her Ladies of Leisure, and featuring Luxie. So the next song we're looking at is, I would say, pretty different. I think it describes itself as psychedelic folk.
That sounds about right. And this is the one that I teased earlier. This involves the harp. So like I said, I want to hear more harp music in 2021. If you're all listening out there, the Milwaukee music scene, and I know you are, I just want to hear more harp. This is a new project from a group called Mirror of Light. Now, it's headed up by an artist. Her name is Elise McCardle. Folks may know her from another Milwaukee group called Cream Vellum. And she's put together this new project called Mirror of Light. She had kind of got a hold of me near the end of 2020 and wanted to release this track through Milwaukee Record early in the new year. And I listened to it, and I was immediately taken by it, and I immediately loved the idea of kind of easing into a new year with this very, very pastoral, very, very haunting. She describes the song as being cobbled together from, quote, material from sound archives, field recordings, fairy tales, and folk ballads. And it comes from Mirror of Light's upcoming EP, which I believe she is going to be releasing this spring. The EP is called Fell Tales, and the song we'll be listening to is called Moon from a Well.
Candles, lights, moons, glistening with rain from the day. No mortal touch could bring my body to rest.
Oh,
of light. This next group that we'll be looking at is actually a band that I know somewhat well, and again, a very different genre.
Yes, we are turning this car. We're making a sharp turn here again. A very, very sharp turn to enjoy the latest offering from terrific Milwaukee rock group Foxface. Foxface has been around, probably for about a decade or so in one form or another, but they really started making noise and really kind of put themselves on the map in 2017 with their debut full-length record. It was called Spoil and Destroy. Foxface is this very kind of aggressive, very, very awesome feminist punk rock, garage rock group, but with tons of hooks to spare, as you might say. Their music, you know, it's always very timely. It's not just noise, it's not just anger, it's noise and anger filtered through some solid pop hooks, which I always appreciate. Their latest album is called End of Man. That should also kind of give you an idea of where they're coming from here. And the song we're going to be listening to is just kind of this chugging head bopper of a song. It's called Slow Burn, the latest from Foxface.
That was Slow Burn by Foxface. You mentioned earlier that one of these songs was a re-release, and I'm guessing it's this last one. When I looked up the group, I was surprised at just how old the band actually is.
Yes, this is the re-release I was hinting at earlier. The group was called The Trusty Knife, who were really active in the mid-2000s. So it's been a while now, you know, 15 years or so. They were putting out music at a time when it's a really interesting period for me because it was really before SoundCloud, it was before Bandcamp, and it was before streaming music became what it is today. And because of that, I think a lot of their music and a lot of groups from that era are kind of like lost to time. If you were a DIY group back then, you were likely only putting out music on CDs and probably burnt CDs that you burnt in, you know, your Windows XP computer. And now, 15 years later or whatever, a lot of those CDs, and I have a bunch still and recently kind of tried to listen to them, and like half of them just don't work anymore. They just don't play. And so a lot of this music is kind of lost to time. Happily, late last year, Milwaukee record label Dusty Medical Records reissued the debut album from The Trusty Knife. It's a self-titled album, and kind of remastered it, put it out on all the modern streaming services, Apple Music, Spotify, of course, and issued it on vinyl for the very first time. And it's such a fantastic record. It really takes me back to going to these shows from this band, and they were always just a ton of fun. And I actually wrote a piece about them on our website today. And so many people kind of came out of the woodwork and said, oh my God, I remember those shows. They were amazing. I can't believe I haven't heard this album in years. Thanks for kind of writing about this. And that's how I feel about this record. Dusty Medical also reissued two follow-up albums that the Trusty Knife put out that were rarely heard. So it's nice to see a group from that era kind of being rescued from the mists of time. The track we're going to be listening to is called Stealin', and it's kind of this jaunty little number. It really takes me back, and boy, yeah, you're right. It was a long time ago, but it's great to hear The Trusty Knife once again.
Situation when we heard the alarm call up out of the blue.
That was Stealing by The Trusty Knife. Hopefully, if this grouping of songs is any indication, 2021 will be a great year for Milwaukee music.
I hope so. I assume so. Milwaukee music has not let me down yet. I always try to get some stuff that's all across the board. I can guarantee you that the rest of the year will be as eclectic, if not more eclectic, as this. So I'm looking forward to another great year. I'm looking forward to a new year. I'm looking forward to a brand new everything. So yeah, it's great to be back. And yeah, looking forward to 2021.
Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record. Every month, he publishes his Milwaukee Music Roundup and joins Lake Fextoy Powers to talk about a few of those songs. You can find our previous Milwaukee Music Roundups at WUWM.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers joins me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Mayon Silver and Jack Herbanis. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Chuck Kornbach from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. Join us again on Monday for a look at the Milwaukee Rep's celebration of Black History Month. Plus, Bubbler Talk clears up the muddled history behind why we put soda in our old fashions. Are we truly the only state that does this?
Yes, we are. If you order an old fashioned anyplace else in the world, it's going to be whiskey, usually rye, bitters, sugar, maybe a little water. That's it. It's garnished with a lemon peel or an orange peel. It doesn't have fruit. It does not have soda at all.
If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. And if you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast from Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.